You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Since the war in Iraq began, a climate of heightened nationalism and a silencing of dissent have enveloped the country. But according to Richard Nelson, Barry Lopez, and Terry Tempest Williams, co-authors of the book Patriotism and the American Land, true patriotism means something entirely different from simply supporting the troops and hanging a flag in your front yard. Speaking with Peace Watch earlier today, Nelson, Lopez, and Williams explore a more in-depth meaning of the word terrorism, patriotism, and homeland security, and they take us on an earthly and spiritual journey that redefines patriotism from a whole new perspective. I picked up this book on patriotism and the American land. There's a picture of a tattered, well-worn flag on the cover, and to be honest, I expected to read essays about discussions about supporting the troops or not supporting the troops, free speech, homeland security. But yet it's not. This book that you all have all contributed to is a very fresh new definition of patriotism. You pose the question, what is the true meaning of patriotism? Which is why I asked you, Terry Tempest Williams, what would a good patriot do in response to the situation that you articulated about the wilderness protection?
I think what good patriots do is pay attention. They respond, they speak, they act, and they question everything. And I think it's our moral obligation and patriotic duty to make these issues forefront.
Terry, you have a unique definition of homeland security in times of terror. At one point you write, we need a patriotism that offers to the rest of the world an authentic and visionary example of leadership. What do you mean by that?
Leadership comes in many forms, and whether it's grassroots organizing, whether it's land trusts where we bring together disparate groups from the community. I think leadership is not from the top down, but from the bottom up. And to me, the most powerful place to begin with this kind of leadership is within our own communities. I think that's where we really can make a difference, where we can see the fruits of our labor, and where we can make lasting impressions, even with our own neighbors.
Richard Nelson, you're joining us from Alaska. In your essay, Patriots for the American Land, you talk about an enlightened form of patriotism. And you cite the Koyukon Indians of Alaska as examples of good patriots. What is it about their culture that qualifies them as such, in your opinion?
Well, I think we have a lot to learn from indigenous people like the Koyukon Indians in Alaska and many other indigenous people all over North America and throughout the world who basically have as the most important premise in their culture standing up for the land that they stand on. These are people who recognize that their lives are drawn directly from the land, as are all of our lives. And the difference is, I think, that we have forgotten what these people who live closer to the land know it so clearly that often it's difficult for them to articulate it. It's so much a part of who they are. For example, Koyukon people up here in Alaska have a very rich, spiritually based relationship to the land. They see themselves as not owners or dominators of the natural world, but as members of a community that includes humans, but also includes everything else. And I think that's maybe the most fundamental patriotism of all, is one that says, everything that lives on the earth is a part of my community. I am a part of that same community, and my first duty is to stand up for that community, to show allegiance toward it, to support its right to exist. And also underlying all that is the recognition that our own lives come from that. You know, I think a more enlightened and wiser and deeply rooted idea of patriotism is one that recognizes our complete dependence on the land itself.
Well, when you embrace the philosophy, or if one were to embrace the philosophy that you've just articulated, it would be very difficult then to move into the type of patriotism that requires you, the sort of nationalism that we've witnessed as a response to the September 11th tragedies leading up to the war on Iraq. What do you say to the American that it's feeling as though they're patriotic because they are concerned that our country, our land, was attacked by foreigners in the World Trade Center, and they somehow feel that to be patriotic is to support the president and the troops?
We talk about the September 11th tragedy as an attack on the American people, but at the same time, as I know Terry has talked about this, that we are, in a sense, our own people, our own government, our own corporations are attacking the land too. You know, we are not just being attacked, we are attackers on the earth of our own nation. And we need to, first of all, take care of our own house here. And taking care of our own house means literally that. This continent is the house in which we live. And so I think we need to go back first to the roots of our own patriotism and say we need to take care of the land that gives us our lives. The cornfields of Iowa, the rangelands of the West, the orchards of the East, all these places that sustain us from where our water and air and food comes. Step back. Look at patriotism first as it applies to you right here at home. And is your government serving you well when it treats the land, as Terry just described, taking away the protections from some of the greatest treasures of the American landscape, the places where we not only rejuvenate our bodies but also our souls? So I would talk about that patriotism first.
Mm-hmm. Barry, you talk about becoming a culture of naturalists. Is there a connection between that and being a good patriot, in your opinion?
The thing that we've lost sight of is that we're biological, and like a group of kids turned loose with a chemistry set in the third or fourth grade, we have industries with really no good idea at all about what sort of effect they're having on long-term health of the land, long-term health of bodies of water, filling these places with carcinogenic substances, for example, that endanger our health. If an idea like homeland security is ultimately to have any integrity, any meaning at all, it means that you must secure your homeland by taking care of it. To me, much of what is going on in the realm of patriotism, at least in the popular media, is the discussion of stuff that we went through and got over in the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. It doesn't take much of a soul or a heart or an intellect to respond to what happened on 9/11. The real heart, the real soul, the real intellect is to take the punch in the nose and say, I wonder what that was about, and I wonder what we can do to keep it from happening again. And I don't see us doing that. And one approach I think I've taken and Dick has taken and Terry as well is to say, let's pull back a little bit and look at what's going on between a people and a place and see if we can't revise the legal structure that arranges those relationships so that it ensures our longevity. In Oregon, for example, I sit here this morning, my state is 50th in its ability to feed its people. It is 50th in its ability to take care of its children, that is, to pay for their schooling. It is 50th in the list of states funding the arts. We are about to become the first of the 50 states to lose public funding for public broadcasting. These things, to me, signal a culture that's been stood on its head. To feel patriotic because somebody won a war, which was never in question to begin with in Iraq, and you can't feed your children, you can't take care of your land, and you can't educate your people, is to be living a nightmare that's dressed up as a fantasy.
Let me ask this question to either of you who care to respond. Is it possible that President-elect George Bush had an opportunity to become a visionary world leader by taking the high road in response to September 11th? Anyone care to respond to that?
Well, what's the high road?
Forgiveness.
Okay.
One thing that's said in political anthropology from looking at the ways that people organize and lead their societies around the world is the weakest are the strongest. What this means is that when your leadership is weak, it needs to use muscle to sustain itself. When your leadership is strong, it embraces people and their needs, as Barry outlined, for a rich life in terms of education, in terms of community, in terms of that interweaving of people that makes a society itself so strong that it doesn't need a strong-arming leadership. And it seems that what we have done in our response to September 11th is rather than, as Barry was saying, rather than taking the path of openness and forgiveness and understanding and looking at our own society and seeing how we can find ultimate strength, which is to embrace other humans in a way that creates that strength as trees do, for example. You know, you can see a forest of trees as here on the west coast of the United States where there's a very, very shallow soil. And you look at these giant coniferous trees, 150, 200 feet tall, and they're standing on these little pedestals, and you wonder, how do they keep themselves from toppling over in the storms? The way they do it is by weaving all their roots together with each other. They don't do it by trying to stand alone, because they know that the one great tree can't stand by itself. It needs the roots of all those other trees to hold it up. And so the weakest is the strongest means that the sort of response that would have been appropriate to 9/11 would be to weave our roots together with the other humans around the world and help to hold them up instead of acting like a storm that goes in and pitches them over.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what our president did that was a grievous error is to run across the world like a great storm blowing trees over rather than to help to hold our other human brethren up.
I think what we're beginning to see and what we've been seeing since September 11th and really even before with this administration is that it's a mind that is closed to the possibilities rather than open to them. And it's a mind that is closed to the rest of the world, open only to what America is in the most banal sense, not in the greatest sense. I think when minds close, democracy begins to close, and a closed society inspires terror and the tyranny of belief. When democracy disappears, we're asked to accept the way things are, and we are being told that we are engaged in a war on terror. Patriots act. They are not handed a piece of paper called by that same name and asked to comply. We are being asked to comply to this monoculture of vision. It's a cornfield versus what Dick's talking about, you know, in terms of a diverse forest.
Many have, thank you all for those eloquent responses to the questions. Many throughout this whole anti-war movement, this movement for peace, have carried signs saying no oil for blood. And they have concluded that the resource of oil that flows so freely in the Middle East, in Iraq, has been the real reason behind this war against that country, oil that is also flowing in parts of this country in Alaska as well. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that and about the natural resources that we as the people and parts of the human family have to share on this earth.
Well, I've got a thought about oil, and it brings into sharp focus, I think, where this administration, which I personally don't feel a lot of antipathy toward the administration. What I feel is sadness that the responses to our dilemmas are so witless.
Barry Lopez.
Yes, and the administration has come up with the obvious answer to human plight in so many instances. There's never been the next effort, which, as Dick says, is a little bit more complicated. What good solutions can we come up with that take a little more thought and ensure less pain, less cruelty in the world? If indeed we are fighting a war in Iraq, which it's really a misnomer, it's not a war. It's much closer to something like a police action, an invasion, and an illegal act. And if the reasons behind it are oil reasons and Mr. Cheney and his friends, what we're doing is ensuring our ownership or control of a resource that's going to be very short-lived. The real problem facing us is not oil, but water. Where is our water going to come from? And the interesting thing about water is that it brings us back to our biological needs. The woman or the man walking down the street doesn't really need oil. They can get by without the car and the manufactured items that are petroleum-based. But a human being cannot get by without water. If you went this morning and knocked on the door of the World Bank or any other institution looking to fund exploration or research and development and said, where is our trouble going to come from in the next 100 years? It wouldn't be oil. It would be water. We really, as an organism, Homo sapiens all over the planet, we have no collective idea where our water is going to come from in 25 years. None. And Gail Norden spoke out here in the West a couple of days ago and informed us that the administration was setting aside $11 million. $11 million doesn't fund 10 minutes of what's going on in Iraq. That's what was going to be set aside to look into these water issues in the American West. This isn't just madness. This is a stupidity so deep it takes language away from you. You do not know how to respond to a group of people who say patriotism is killing, patriotism is securing natural resources so we can protect our way of life. To be a patriot is to look in the mirror and say, I am going to answer a question so hard it will take me the rest of my life and its solution will not be reached in my lifetime. But I love my children, so I will live fiercely for my children my whole life to discover a greatness in myself, a greatness in what I have invented as a culture. That's where we need to go with patriotism, not figuring out a fancier gun or taking oil so we can secure our set of toys for another 20 or 25 years. Mm-hmm. Patriotism demands of people the very depths of their souls. And if you don't have the courage to do it, or you're not old enough to do it, and I think those are the two things in Washington, then you should just have the integrity to step out of the way and let women and men who want to take care of their children step to the fore and not have to be intimidated by Homeland Security rumors that to do that is to risk being put in jail.
Barry Lopez, Richard Nelson, you cite the Koyukon Indians of Alaska. You quote a Native American elder in your essay who says, the country knows if you do wrong things to it. The whole country knows. It feels what's happening to it. I guess everything is connected together somehow under the ground.
There is that sense, I think, that's deeply ingrained in the traditions of, as far as I know, all of the indigenous people of North America. And perhaps it's the fundamentally human way of looking at the world, if we look at indigenous peoples everywhere on Earth, that acknowledges sacredness and spirituality and power in the earth itself without speculating as to whether the earth and all of the beings around us have that kind of power. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that that is a deeply wise way of looking at the world, because what it does, when you say the country knows, the whole country knows if you do wrong things to it, what you're saying is that the country itself, that the land underfoot, knows what's going on, that it's more powerful than you are, and that your first obligation then is to serve that land. And I think that one of the ways that we could stand to learn a lot from in modern America is this one, that we should acknowledge that the land itself is greater than we are, and that our first and most important duty as citizens of this continent is to do service to it, to take care of it, to live responsibly on it, to be patriotic, ultimately, to this land itself. And so this kind of wisdom that has emerged over many, many thousands of years on the continent where we today share the land with indigenous people, this is a wisdom that I think we have ignored for the 500 years that Europeans have been here, and we could benefit enormously by paying attention to it. I think the Native American people have a lot to teach the rest of us about living here in this continent, and therefore about what is a bigger and deeper and wiser notion of what patriotism is about.
Richard Nelson. Terry Tempest Williams, you have cited individuals in your book who you feel as though have sort of gotten the point about patriotism and have lived out their lives as such. Is there someone that you'd care to present to us at this time as a good example of a patriot?
Bill Hedden comes to mind. He was a former county commissioner for Grand County in Moab, Utah. He lives just down the road from us in Castle Valley. He has spent the last 15 years trying to get people's attention in the community, in the county, in the state of Utah. He's gone back to Washington over and over again trying to point out that there are, I think, 10 million tons of radioactive waste sitting on the banks of the Colorado River. Finally, after days and days and days, weeks, months, years, decades of vigilance, he finally got the attention of Congress. Congress voted to make a decision to either cap the Atlas tailings from the boom and bust cycle of the uranium industry here in Moab. It passed through Congress. It was one of the last acts of Congress during the Clinton administration. When the Bush administration took office, they stripped the funding from that piece of legislation. And now I can tell you, with big spring winds blowing in the desert, winds so strong, that's why we have arches and canyons here, those winds carrying radioactive waste are covering the playgrounds of our children. I teach in the schools. I can tell you that dust, they're whirling dervishes, and it's a wind that kills. This is one example of a patriot. Bill has not given up, and he continues to lobby Congress. What I would say, Berna, is that democracy is built upon the right to be insecure. We are vulnerable, and we're vulnerable together, and democracy is this beautiful experiment. Again, it's the influence each of us have within our own communities, with our own issues that stand before us now.
Barry?
One of the things that I always look for as a writer is how can a problem that gets defined in a narrow way be broadened so that all of us are included. And I know a person who Richard Nelson and Terry and myself all admire is Rachel Carson.
Yes.
For many reasons. But one is, this is one of the bravest human beings the United States has ever produced. She was attacked on all sides when she wrote Silent Spring, and it's many decades later that everybody knows that she was right. She was a warning angel. She came here and she used her scientific mind to say, what we're doing in the chemical industry is one day going to kill us. We must stop. And the industry and its friends, including those in the administration, tried everything they could to quiet her, to push her out of the way, to belittle her, to marginalize her. And she stood up sometimes only by herself and continued in her quiet way to testify. So I think of Rachel Carson as a patriot, and other people who come to mind in no particular order are Martin Luther King and Black Elk, the Lakota medicine man, and Thomas Merton, the monk who a lot of people look to as a kind of saint from America. The reason I think of these people is that America is an experiment. A group of people, many of them living in France at the end of the 17th, or end of the 18th century, rather, tried to imagine a society that was just and in which all women and men had equal rights and equal opportunity. And they knew from their history in Europe that it was not going to happen there, but it could happen, and it did happen in America. Mm. America became the greatest experiment in democracy, the greatest experiment in equality, the greatest experiment in justice human minds have ever devised. And it is still going on. And the reason I think of Martin Luther King and Black Elk and Thomas Merton and Rachel Carson as patriots is because they were fully engaged in the central difficulty. And the central difficulty is, how do you make peace between things that are different, whether it's oil and water, or blacks and whites, or Chicanos? How do you bring the races, the different groups of political opinion together, and ensure that the good thought will end up on the table, and there won't be weapons, there won't be shouting, there won't be accusation? And each one of these people, I know, you know, you can say of all of them probably that you could go, if you were mean-spirited, and dig in their backgrounds and find out they weren't perfect human beings. This isn't remotely news. No one cares about that. We're led, as Terry said, by fallible people. But if we look to Martin Luther King, and we look to Black Elk, the Lakota medicine man, and we look to Thomas Merton in these different arenas of their intellectual and spiritual activity, what we see is men and women who never quit when it came to bringing the one side together with the other side. They lived in the most fearful place, and that's the gray zone. And the great sadness to me of our behavior in Iraq is that it is the reaction of a fundamentalist mind, and the first sign of fundamentalism is failure of imagination.
Barry Lopez. And finally, Terry, in your essays, you do cite several passages from Rachel Carson's writings. I'm wondering if there's one in particular that you'd like to read for us at this time in closing.
Thank you, Berna. If the Bill of Rights contains no guarantee that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed either by private individuals or by public officials, it is surely only because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem.
Terry Tempest Williams, along with Richard Nelson and Barry Lopez, co-authors of the book Patriotism and the American Land. As the nation launched its preemptive war against Iraq last month, many actors, musicians, and celebrities who questioned the administration's motives were suddenly silenced and shunned by the media and other members of the artistic community. Among the casualties was the music group The Dixie Chicks, after lead singer Natalie Maines told a London crowd she was ashamed the president is from her home state of Texas. Peter Beauchamp, producer of All Mixed Up at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, presents this musical mix.
The word is...
The scent.
Yeah,
this not coming down. This is a disagree.
With a D sound or without a D sound?
Just so you know, we're ashamed. The President of the United States is from Texas.
Am I sorry I said that? Yes. Am I sorry I spoke out? No. Am I sorry that I ask questions and that I don't just follow? No.
Dissent.
Yeah,
this not coming down. This is a disagree.
The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us.
Thank y'all for pulling the Dixie Chicks.
Can I read a quote from President Theodore Roosevelt, former president? To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public.
I love their songs, but I don't agree with what they did.
Thank y'all for pulling the Dixie Chicks.
This was how I broke the bands.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch, produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Mike Aloney and Binta Berkland. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.
What you need. It is all you need.
I think we in South Carolina ought to say goodbye to the Dixie Chicks.